Succession number 11748, row 5.
Colonel Ismail Khan, row 5.
So when I found the sign, the first 13 friendly was rifles. They were all in code. So I took my motorcycle in, stopped it, and went in and saw Captain McCulloch of the first 13. So I said, "Where have you come from?" I said, "You see, I told him that I missed their sign and went on ahead." So he said, "Was that I was, messing about at their minefield?" I said, "What do you mean minefield?" He said, "They laid a minefield on the road." So he said, "Good God," he said, "we were told that a Jap motorcyclist is in front and he's stopping over the minefield." So I was just about to send a platoon, a fighting patrol, to go and scupper them. He said, "You're bloody lucky you got away with it." He said, "Then what were you doing on the minefields?" I said, "Those potholes I saw." So I watched them and turned my motorbike over them and came back. He said, "Do you realize you could have been blown up?" I said, "Of course I could have been, but I don't know that." Then he took me to the CO's bunk, where he was there, Colonel Golly Gilbert. His second command, as I told you, was wounded, Golly Mitchell, and the CO was Golly Gilbert. Great, great, great gentleman and soldier. So when he saw me, he said, "Hello, Ismail." Before he saw me, McCulloch said, "Sir, Ismail is here. He nearly got killed." He said, "What? Ismail is killed?" He said, "No, sir, he's here." Then he saw me. So then he heard the story from me that I nearly blew up his tank mines on the road. So there he told me that Australians are withdrawing, and he got information from them, and they've already started thinning out towards their right. So I said, according to our information, the Australians were there to hold the front. Well, he said, "No, they're withdrawing, so you better get back and tell everybody." So I got back, stayed to my CO, and I told him. And he, in turn, sent me 8 miles back to the brigade headquarters, where we had got a new brigade commander called Brigadier Lay. His battalion, he was from Leicestershire Regiment, I think, if I'm not mistaken. His battalions were wiped out. He was acting brigade commander. Japanese attacked his brigade headquarters, and he got away just by himself, shooting his way out. The rest were all killed. So his nerves are quite shaken. So I got the brigade headquarters, and Mike Tice from our battalion was a G3 intelligence there. I conveyed to him, I said, "The Australians have withdrawn on the right of the 1st 13th. So immediately informed the Div headquarters. By then we had come under the command of the 11th Div. And Billy Key had become the Div commander in place of General Murray Lawrence. Because Murray Lawrence were quite shattered by then, you see, when he had lost the whole thing. So we came back and we prepared to withdraw. So we started withdrawing from there. By then, a day before that, which was the 15th of January by now, we really came in for some extraordinary shelling and air bombardment by the Japanese. We were quite fed up that we never saw our own air force to support us. And the men were also feeling the pinch. And lo and behold, suddenly, one morning, we saw our Air Force coming from the south, flying low over our positions, some bombers, some fighters, and zooming in the skies, and the men were cheering for the first time they saw their own Air Force. But that did not stop us withdrawing from there, because on the western side, towards Moar River, our two brigades, which had just landed from India, 45th Brigade and 43rd Brigade, came in for a great deal of mauling. and 11 divas could not hold their positions, and we were told to withdraw. So we withdrew then, slowly along the road, back to the thing, and we came to a place called, I'll skip the details of little battles, day-to-day battles, but we withdrew from there 15th of January. About the 15th of January, we started withdrawing, and we came down the road again, and we were told to go to the positions in, down the road. We started withdrawing from there on about the 15th of January and came through the road, like positions like Bulak Kesep and Yongpeng and things like that. Finally, we were fighting, withdrawing by day, fighting by, withdrawing by night and fighting by day. We would, for example, the drill was, we would fight the Japanese the whole day, and then by the evening we'll start thinning out. Then I, as an intelligence officer, will take company reps, a rep from each company, from headquarter company, two or three reps, and from A company, three reps from B company, C company, and D company. Quite a bit of a party. And I would, we'd get into trucks after a couple of, after a few hundred yards behind the forward defensive lines, and drive down the road to the next pre-selected position. We would wreck the thing the whole night, and I would assign A company right and B company left and C company in the back and D company here and company headquarters here. The reps would go and mark the places up and go to sleep. In the morning, the battalion would appear, early hours in the morning. As they appeared, the reps would go and take their subunits to their positions, and they would start digging and making their recces and put their men in. By about sunrise, the Japs would appear. First, the bicycle party would come. They'll bump into our positions. We'd fire at them. They would stop, and the rest of the infantry would arrive during the day. Then they would attack us the whole day. Either they would find our flanks, go around our flanks. There was the curse of the whole fighting in the jungle. You couldn't cover a whole area. Because if you went out of sight of each other, you could be 100 yards away. So you had to be in visual contact with each other. Or by single men patrols, telling you where you are. So Japanese picked up a novel method of frightening us. They had a kind of a crackers, which they would shoot to your flanks and hit the trees. As the shell would hit a tree, it will explode into small crackers and is to make a rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat-a-tat noise, like machine gun bullets being fired. So we would get the impression the Japs have gone around us. So that is to save the Japs. Lot of ammunition, lot of force, and is to give us an indication that we are being surrounded. So it hurry up our withdrawal. So after a few instances like this, we discovered that it was a hoax. Men would never break around us. But still we would send patrols out to find out. So that was on. So for quite a few days and nights, we fought on again, fighting by day and withdrawing by night in the drill that I told you. Now, the only significant incident which happened, which had a bearing on the existence of our 9th Division, was when we withdrew from there, as I left you. We came to various burning towns and things like that, and we came to a position called Yongpeng. And then from Yongpeng, we came to a position called Rangam. Rangam, we were there. At night, we arrived there. In the morning, the Japs started fighting, attacking us. As we were fighting, we got the orders to withdraw immediately and get on, swing on through the railway line, which was on the right of the road. There was a difficult, because it's the second time that we were told to withdraw when we were in contact with the enemy, which is not an easy thing to do. We did it. We came onto the railway line. Battalion strung out the railway line to withdraw in practically in double file practically on both sides of the railway line. And our ambulance platoon, which consisted of all our band people, pipers and drummers and buglers, were there. And they were trying to get their stretchers and their medicine boxes and chests to get onto the railway line. When the Japanese bombing raid took place, and one plane dropped a load of bombs straight onto them, and we lost 14 of our best bandsmen. Pre-war trained bandsmen we lost. There was a bad blow to the battalions morale to lose all the stretcher bands in one go. So we withdrew along the railway line, came to a position called, a place called Liang Liang, L-A-Y-A-N-G, Liang Liang, two worlds. While 22nd Brigade was supposed to have been in front of us. We arrive in Liang Liang at night, secure in the knowledge that the 22nd Brigade is in front of us. Suddenly we heard, we were being shelled. And we quickly discovered that there were the tanks shelling us, Japanese tanks. That gave us a very uncomfortable moment. My God, if the tanks could come through from our right, it means they have either gone around the 22nd Brigade or they have scuppered the 22nd Brigade. But the fact remained that they were there. And we are just settling down after days and nights of fighting to sit down and have an evening meal, which had come along the railway line for us by the quartermaster senders, by the railway trolleys. And we got up and we started in the dark taking up positions. Very uncomfortable night was spent. In the morning we pushed forward B Company and A Company to the left of the road, and A Company and C Company to the right of the road, railway line, and we made a box. So I and our commanding officer, we went for a little recce, saw the companies and came back. I had completed my intelligence map with China graph pencils that we were, our positions were intact. Just as my CO and I, we came back and sat under a clump of bushes, a trolley came on the railway line with our divisional commander, Major General Bostow. I mentioned him earlier on. Major General Bostow and an Australian major, staff officer with him, and Anchor Renzi, this Dane I told you about, who was our engineer there. So they came and they walked up to our position. I and my CO stood up. And he said, "Well, John," to our CO, "where are the Japanese?" John was obviously perturbed. He had heard that we were fired at, that the tanks were between us and the 22nd Brigade. "Have you seen any Japs?" So I told the general, "Japs are all over the place." He said, "Have you seen any?" He said, "No, sir, I haven't seen any." "But they are in the jungle, in front of us." So the general looked at our CO and swore and said, "Well, I'm buggered if I stay here. I'm going forward to meet my 22nd Brigade." And he moved forward. I looked at my CO and said, "Sir, the place is lousy with Japanese." He said, "What can I do?" He stunned us. And he jumped in this trolley, railway push trolley, on the railway line. And within a matter of 2 minutes, 3 minutes, we heard a rat-a-tat-tat of fire. So my CEO turned on to me and said, "Well, that's the division commander being scuppered." I tried to go forward. My CEO restrained me. He said, "Don't you dare go forward. Then he told me to go up to the B company and tell the B company to attack the in the front of his position, the high feature, and occupy it. And he told the C company to attack the feature in front of them on the right of the railway line. As they went to an attack, CEO again sent me forward to go and tell Alan Coombe, Captain Alan Coombe, the commander, company commander, A company, to hang on there like hell and tell the B company to withdraw through him. Because they were suffering very heavy casualties. For example, on our right, on the right of the railway line, C company was left only with about 26 men. The rest were all killed and wounded. So he was told to likewise to withdraw back. And I ran forward, went and rolled down the ridge, and down in between two ridges I found Captain Wilson, Tug Wilson, stand there, pistol in hand, and looking picture of dejection. I said, there you are, my 1.5 year at Sandhurst, and all my preparations for the war is finished today. I've lost my company. And he had lost about 30 men dead and wounded, 30, 35 men dead and wounded, similar like B company. And I said, withdraw. And there I saw, we have acquired the wounded, walking wounded, stretcher bearers, the few that we had. They were acquired the wounded. And I went up through to Alan Coombe behind. And I said, Alan, now you've got to hold the front. He said, all right. And I ran down across the railway line and told the B company, D company. And there was Harvey Kelly. He said, it's all right, don't you worry. Prem is withdrawing. He's got a lot of casualties. And we sat there. And then my CEO told me to go and contact the Australians on our left. There was about a mile distance between us and the Australians, a little more than a mile. And I took about 6 men with me. And we went up and practically rushing through the undergrowth, the foliage, the jungle. And I reached the Australian position. They were in a rubber estate by then. So the Australian commanding officer told me that, well, they promised us air support and there was none. And we have been here, my men are tired, and I'm going to withdraw. In fact, they had already started thinning out. So I hurried back to my battalion, practically running all the way back. Came back and told my CEO that our stains are withdrawing from your left leg is open. And there's not very much between us and them because there's a slight bit of jungle which is negotiable and then they're rubber estates. So he told me, go back and tell the brigade commander. So again I ran back down the railway line and told the brigade headquarters that our stains are pulling out. So in all these 2 instances I told you, the stains will pull out without telling anybody. No particular contact with us. On both occasions, I went in contact with the Australians. Probably the other battalions must have done it too. But we found no Australians coming to contact us. They had a peculiar way of fighting. They thought since the Indian Army had blown it and they're withdrawing, and they're holding the front, and they can do it entirely on their own, which they couldn't do. Anyhow, so we withdrew again on the railway line, the following night at night, and we came back to a position called Kolai. Kolai, we held the positions, and that was again now, it's about the 20th of January, after 20th of January now. Finally, from Johor State, when we reached there, after a day's fighting, we were told that we would be picked up by the Australian transport. There was the 31st of January. So 31st of January, we got into Australian transport. And as the Australian transport arrived, they were a very cheerful lot. Every driver had a supply of Australian whiskey with them and beer with them. So I was running up and down distributing men in the trucks. And my CEO, the delightful Colonel Frith, very quiet man, very nice man, but a great soldier. He gave me a swig from his bottle of whiskey, which I took. Great gulp. As I went to each Australian driver, putting my men into the trucks. They were giving me an odd nip too. So then my CO found me shouting and yelling, talking to people with a loud voice. So he said he wished he hadn't given me that bloody whiskey to keep my voice a bit down. Then we got in the trucks. Every one of us fell asleep. And we crossed the Johor Bahru Straits into Singapore on the early hours of the morning of 31st, or the 1st January morning. Really, we arrived there.
1st of February.
1st of February, yes. 31st of January, we were there. Then we were put in a position in the Singapore island in a woodley farm and things like that. When we arrived in Singapore, we were put down at the United Plantation area on the island, and we began to reorganize from the next morning. Men were tired. They lost most of their equipment, clothing, everything upcountry. And our casualties were over 450 men dead and wounded. So we were terribly understrength. In a few days' time, we heard that a draft from India had arrived for us, of 400 men with a few officers. Some British officers who had gone out on courses to India before the Japanese attack, they had come back, and a couple of Indian officers with them. One was Captain Burhanuddin. He was from Chitral State in the Northwest Frontier Province, Captain Burhanuddin. But he arrived there as a lieutenant. And he had a varied career in the army. He was commissioned from Indian Military Academy, Dehradun. He was commissioned, I think, 1935-36. And he was posted to 5 Baluch, my regiment. We were 2nd Baluch, he was 5 Baluch. He volunteered to join the Air Force. So he joined the Indian Air Force, under Royal Indian Air Force. And he was flying Wapitis in these planes. Amazing character, slightly eccentric, rather more eccentric than normal. For example, he used to take his Volterra dog during the bombing raids on the frontier against the tribesmen in the cockpit. One day, he suddenly got an idea that bombing poor, defenseless tribesmen and their villages is wrong, morally wrong. So he didn't bomb and came back. Why didn't you bomb? He said, my bomb lever was jammed. And then he said, no, my bomb lever was all right. He said, he didn't want to bomb. Why? He said, because we all bloody were wrong, the killing them. Poor buggers in their villages and things like that. But we tell them to leave their homes, go away, we just bomb their mud huts. He said, mud hut is just as bad because you bomb their mud huts, then the poor buggers have got to rebuild it. It's too much, so I shan't do it. He was sent back to the army. When he went back to the army, he went to the regimental center. Because 5 Baluch was, I think, going on, were in the jungle training somewhere else, so he was sent to regimental center in Karachi. And from there, they were sending a draft, so he came as officer replacement. When he arrived, and he was all his family, his elder brother, Khushwakt ul-Mulk, a great soldier, very well-known chap. And so I was a bit sympathetic towards him. And he stood there and said that he should be a captain, or if not a major. Completely disgruntled. The next chap was a Captain Temaya. The Indian General Temaya's elder brother, he belonged to the Army AIRO meant that Army in India Reserve of Officers. He was a captain. He was just as small and tiny as his elder brother was tall. He was very small, so he joined us. And during the reorganization period, we discovered that the men were short of clothing. The draft which came from India had no steel helmets, had no regular uniforms, no kind of even decent ammunition boots. So that the battalion went on to work. Peter Campbell was our adjutant, then he became a SAN commander. Our SAN commander falling sick and going to a quiet job in Singapore. So he became SAN commander. And into the bargain, our CO was transferred. Lieutenant Colonel John Frith, who had been with the battalion since 1922, and he had commanded the battalion brilliantly from Kota Bharu down to Singapore. He is now deceased. He died in 1982 in Vancouver. So Peter Campbell was saying, come on, and we got a Major Parker, P.W. Parker, Philip Parker. He was from 24th Regiment, 12th 24th Regiment. And he was a grade 2 staff officer at the Indian Corps headquarters. So he was sent to command us. There was a bit of a jolt that our regular Baluchi had gone, Baluchi regimental officer gone, and from 24th Regiment, we had to accept him. He came back with the typical staff officer's ideas that the Indian troops did not fight very well up country. So he thought that the usual baseless rumors that our men did not like to go wallow in mud. They did not stand up to rain and mud. And there was other odd, because we had done this fighting from 8th of December till 31st of January up country against heaviest odds. And he tried to take us out on a mud-larking trip. The whole battalion would go mud-larking in the mangrove swamps. I, having been an old warrior by then, and knew how to dodge work. So I went to Peter Campbell, our SAN commander, who was our erstwhile adjutant, and a brilliant adjutant. I told him, Peter, I've got to go to the Cambridgeshire battalion. They were a territorial battalion. They had come with the 18th British Division to Singapore. And they were in the position in front of us, holding the east side of Singapore Island. So I said I would go and take their positions on my map, because we were told that in case of attack on their front, we will go as a we will have a counter-attacking role behind them. So I took off, dressed up in my cleanest possible uniform, and on my motorbike, and I said goodbye to my battalion. They were going mudlarking. I said, you're welcome to it. And I went off to see the Cambridgeshire battalion. Little did I know that a fate much worse than mudlarking was awaiting me the other side. When I arrived there, I met a couple of sentries, and I said, I would like to see your battalion headquarters. So they quietly, silently took me to a captain. Nice man with a little thin moustache as I had. And I looked at him and I said, I'm Ismail from 2nd Baluch behind you. And I've come here to, that I've gone there to put their positions on my map. I'm the intelligence officer. So he took me to another officer and told me to sit down. He said, have you got any identification papers? So I laughed.